Hello, and welcome to the Shakespeare & Company podcast with me, Adam Biles. If you enjoy this conversation, there are a few different ways you can support us. You can buy a book from our online store, shakespeareandcompany.com, including the title discussed in this episode, a link to which you'll find in the show notes. There, you'll also find our Year of Reading subscription, as well as Shakespeare & Company totes, apparel, mugs, and other gifts, all shipped from Paris to wherever you are in the world. You can also become a friend of Shakespeare & Company, a programme we set up to get the bookshop through this difficult year. Membership gets you access to exclusively produced content throughout 2021, as well as other treats depending on the tier you choose. Contributors so far include Molly Crabapple, Aishan Hutchinson, Olivia Lang, Deborah Levy, Kartika Nair, Clemence Poesy, Natalie Portman and George Saunders. You can find out more on friendsofshakespeareandcompany.com. Finally, you can rate this podcast wherever you listen, and if you have time, leave a review. It can really help spread the word. I'll be back at the end. Until then, thank you for listening and enjoy the Shakespeare & Company podcast. Ever since his debut, HHHH, Le Hambinet has been challenging the way his readers approach and interpret historical events, forcing us to question the strange alchemical substance that's produced in the no man's land where fact and narrative meet. His third novel continues this trend, asking how things could have unravelled differently for the world if certain historical coin tosses from more than five centuries ago had landed tails instead of heads. The result, Civilizations, is one of the most original, entertaining and thought-provoking novels of the year, and I'm delighted to say that Laurent Binet joins us in the bookshop today. Laurent, welcome to the Shakespeare & Company podcast.
Thank you.
I suppose where I want to begin is referring to the last conversation we had when you were with us to talk about the seventh function of language. And one thing that I said, I think, in the introduction to that was that compared to your first novel, HHHH, the seventh function of language almost seemed to be the other side of the same coin. Like you were doing what you did with HHHH, you were doing almost the complete opposite with the seventh function of language. And in a sense, I thought maybe that was it. You were done with your sort of interrogation of history. And then with Civilizations, you come along and I suddenly started thinking maybe this coin has three faces or four faces or all of these different sort of, these different ways of looking at history. There seems to be an almost sort of endless supply of them. Now, to give our listeners a little bit of context, so in the introduction, I mentioned if things had been different 500 years ago. And I suppose one of the ways in which things might have been different in this novel is if Columbus had not made his way back from the United States or from the Americas, as they were at the time. Was that the founding idea of this book, or was there another idea that led to Civilizations?
Well, actually, I don't remember Columbus was the starting point. As far as I remember, really I started with a sentence I read in a book of Jared Diamond, mm-hmm. who worked on various civilizations and why some of them were destroyed or mm-hmm. defeated. And what he said about the Incas was, this is almost the exact quotation. Why is it that Pizarro came to make Atahualpa prisoner and not Atahualpa came to Spain making Charles V prisoner? So that was really the starting point. Everything started with Incas because I just came back from a journey to Peru, mm-hmm. you know, I was invited to some book fair in Lima. So I got interested by those pre-Columbus people and their cultures. And also I got interested by the process of the conquest, mm-hmm. and which was very, I did know almost nothing about it. And it was really amazing how they conquered twice a whole empire, mm-hmm. a whole world with 200 people. And I was fascinated by that story, the mm-hmm. story of the conquest, you know. And after I read the Jade Diamond book, I was wondering about the what if, you know, and I was driven by the idea of the possibility, you know, could it have been possible? And so that was like the lead I followed. Okay, so Cortés, Pizarro, they did that, they did that. Was it possible to transfer their strategy, how they did it? And so that was the starting point. But I also wanted to build something plausible. Mm-hmm. And so I couldn't start right. I didn't want to start right with the Inca's landing in Spain or Portugal, sure. You know. So so I started to climb the hill of the causality, you know, the causes. And of course, the center point was Columbus, you know. But before that, so in a way, Columbus, it was quite simple to write the chapter, you know, the same as the real history. He comes to Cuba and Haiti, but he never comes back, you know. But I needed to explain that. Mm-hmm. That's why I thought about the Vikings. And so the you know, in the what if, in the counterfactual, in the alternate history, there is what you call switching point, or you know. And so the Columbus was had to be the switching point, but not the original cause, you know. So that's why I had to come back to the Vikings to explain why Columbus wouldn't face the poor armless the poor weak Indians he met, the Tainos in Cuba, but strong Indians with weapons and ready to face him and to fight him and to defeat him.
One thing that really comes across in those early chapters, and I think this is probably feeds into the Jared Diamond thing about sort of why this and not that, is the sort of the contingency of history in a way. It's sort of because it was not certain that, for example, Columbus would make it back to Europe. Being an explorer, in the 15th century, was an incredibly dangerous thing to do. It was completely plausible that some little thing might have been different, and Columbus wouldn't have made it back, and then the whole of history would potentially have been different. Was that a sort of a feeling that you had in researching and writing your previous two books as well? Did you get that sort of sense that there was that history as we know it is so fragile in a way?
Yes, well, it was not that clear in my mind at that time, but I think I always had that feeling that what you said about the coin, you know, I always believe that there are big structural moves in history, you know, and it's just not, I don't believe few men made history, but still, I always thought about it, you know, what if Hitler was killed in 39 or 36 or because he had he escaped a huge amount of assassination attempts, you know. Sure. And Nazism was not only Hitler, but still, without Hitler, it wouldn't be the same story, I think. So I was always divided between those two ideas that the history is it's some big machine, you know, a big moving machine, but with key points, you know, key stages, you know. So and the more I worked on civilizations, the more I was convinced that yes, it definitely, this story could have turned differently in so many ways, you know. I mean, like The Chinese could have discovered America before the Europe, and it would have been also another story, you know, but completely different. And about the Spanish, like if, yeah, my idea for my book was if Columbus failed, that would have given to the Indians few years, maybe few decades before Spanish, the Europe, they would have believed that, okay, the West, the way to the West is not that promising, you know.
Sure.
But for instance, like Cortés and Pizarro, they were incredibly lucky, you know, to achieve what they did. But you can imagine that if they failed, some others would follow, and they would. So it wouldn't have been such a big change, you know. So it's not either it's written this way and nothing can change it, or it's pure contingency. Yeah. But what maybe with that way of thinking, what I like the most, following the Jared Diamond theory, is about the germs, you know, like ultimately the germs killed, wiped out 90% of all the Indians of America, you know, and his explanation is that we had more germs and more antibodies because we European, I mean, we were used to manage the animals of the farm. The we had the cows, the pigs, the porks, and the pigs and the Indians, they didn't, you know, they had llamas and things like that, but they didn't have those domestic animals. And so the conclusion of all that is that big part of the world history was shaped just because Europeans they had pigs and not Indians, you know. So this is this is funny to think this way, you know, like it's not about like the one civilization was better or bigger or stronger than the other, but this is pure contingency, you know. Pigs were in Europe and not in America.
It's also sort of, it must be incredibly sort of vertiginous, I think, for a novelist to have to sort of identify these points and to try and understand them, because, you know, we could say, okay, well, it's because in Europe we have the pigs, but then why did we have the pigs? What were the historical contingencies that brought that?
And
that's interesting when you say that you went back, you were thinking of Columbus, and then you were thinking, okay, but then I need to go back to the Vikings as well. And
yeah, sure. I mean, it's an endless process in both ways, you know, coming back to the past, but also projecting to the future, know. And many readers, they told me, well, you stopped, like at the end of the 16th century with Cervantes stepping in in Cuba in America, but you could continue the story. And of course, I mean, this is what's funny with Uchronias, with counterfactual narratives, that you can continue it endlessly, you know, infinitely, you know. And so even, you know, I mean, you can continue the story to our present time, but also beyond, you know, the 22nd century and so on. So that's a vertige. You're right. Yeah.
And I'd like to come back to the thing you were talking about the sort of whether it's the sort of the forces of history or whether it's the kind of the great man theory. And that was one thing that kept coming to me as I was reading the book. And I felt that sort of, you didn't seem interested in resolving the question in a way. It was more just sort of just showing this tension, because of course there are what we might call cameos from certain, you know, great men. You mentioned Pizarro, who makes an appearance, but not in the historical context that we know him. Niccolo Machiavelli is in there. Obviously Thomas More, Erasmus, Luther, Lorenzo de' Medici. But they're sort of, these are people who, in both histories, you know, whether it be the real history, and I'm putting that in inverted commas, or the counterfactual history that you're presenting, there are still these kind of, these great minds and these great figures. And so it felt to me that you were sort of, yeah, you were trying to sort of to navigate the between those two theories in a way.
Yes, you're right. Well, first of all, I mean, once I decided to write a novel, I need characters, you know, sure. So I can't avoid characters, you know, I mean, men and women. But yeah, you're right. I don't answer that question, but I mean, in France, we speak about the l'homme providentiel, the l'homme providentiel.
Yeah, the kind of the man of destiny, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, which I don't believe. Mm. But I believe that, I mean, I believe, I can see that at some point, there is some people, they are the right man in the right place, you know. So it's a coincidence of several factors, you know, like, which make that... In that particular situation, Martin Luther has a huge role in European history, you know, and of course, I mean, in a different situation, he would have been just an unknown priest or something like that. So this is actually, I am fascinated by the chance and luck, you know, like those guys who had an important role in history, they had prominent qualities, you know, to for the worst or the best. I mean, to make what they made, but the first thing. Pizarro and Cortés had was luck. Uh-huh. I'm convinced of that. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. So luck has a huge importance in history.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And I think you put me in mind actually of Machiavelli, because I think that's when he writes about luck. It's sort of this thing of it's not just you know, having things arrive luckily in your life, but it's also having the capacity to put that luck to your use.
Yes, so well, this is what we call the kairos, you know.
Sure.
But I remember in The Prince of Machiavelli, his model is Cesare Borgia, you know, and the man who had all the qualities, you know, to make a great politician, you know, to make a great man, but fortune he didn't have, you know. And that's why he died at 32, I think. For Machiavelli, he had all the qualities to make the ideal prince. Mm-hmm. You know, just the fortune he lacked. He had a lack of fortune.
So in the book, we find, and I'm trying not to give too much away, but we've already talked about it. And I think it's no secret to say that sort of so the Incas make their way over to Europe. Now, one of the ways they're able to do that, in a way, is by kind of repurposing European technology as well, I think, because the sort of the ships left behind by the Vikings, by Columbus, were sort of gave the inspiration and perhaps the knowledge and the sort of the technological know-how for the Incas to make the trip over to Europe and to begin colonizing Europe. As they do in your novel. And I'm really curious about that idea of sort of cultural exchange in a way, because there's sort of, there are clearly things that sort of, for different historical reasons, that the Europeans had developed that the Incas hadn't. And as the book develops, we see certain things that the Incas did, particularly, I think, concerning agriculture and political ideas that the Europeans didn't have. And I'd just like you to talk a little bit about the sort of the creative process of sort of, I guess, of meshing the two cultures in your work.
Yes, well, this was really, I mean, I was just facing problems every time, you know. those people, they lack that. How can I help them to make the balance equal, you know. So so I had the problem with the ships, with the weapons, with the horses, you know. So I had to bring them what they missed, you know. And but also I had to I studied Incas culture, you know, and I was wondering what can they use in their own culture as an asset, as a weapon, you know. And what interested me the most actually was not about technology, but economy, you know, economics and social system, which the Incas social system was very, astonishing and very avant-garde. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, they had a kind of social security. They had, and also this is technology, agriculture. You're right, of course. But they had things that some people in Europe were asking, you know, like the German peasants, farmers, you know, they were asking for a better model, which would not make them starving, and so I was always thinking as a, you know, like the strategy of Cortés and Pizarro. And Cortés, what he did, he made enemies of the Aztecs his friends, his allies, you know. And so I thought, okay, so if Incas, they bring a better model for some part of the European people, then it would help them to find allies, you know. So that was very stimulating mind game.
Did you approach it with a sort of a political eye? I'm just thinking because obviously with a lot of counterfactuals, there is often politics behind it. So people would sort of, you know, if what would have happened if Hitler had been assassinated at this time, what would have happened if, I don't know, the communism had taken, Soviet Union had taken root in Europe. And I think often people use the counterfactual as a way to sort of to explore different political possibilities. And it's definitely the case in civilizations that, you show us the sort of, as you've just talked about, the Incas, say, social system taking root in Europe. But would you say that you had a sort of political agenda, might be speaking a bit strongly, but something that you perhaps saw in the Inca society that was in some way superior to Europe?
Actually, I didn't at the beginning. Mm-hmm. You know, at the beginning, it was just like, it was really like a game, you know, I thought, well, it's funny to give the losers to give a revenge, you know. But then the more and more I studied Europe in the 16th century, Incas culture and so on. Politics came no matter what, you know.
Yeah.
And what I didn't anticipate, for example, you know, I was not a big specialist of the 16th century, but I knew about the religious wars, uh-huh. and, you know, the Protestant, Catholics, everything. But I didn't think that at the same time there was something very important in Europe. It was the beginning of capitalism, you know. And sure. I didn't anticipate that, but studying that time, I could see the importance, growing importance of the bankers, you know. And I didn't know that character, the German banker Fugger, the father, the family, you know, the banker's family in Germany, and that man Fugger, he made the election of Charles V, you know, against Francis the First, and so yes, I mean, it was I realized that capitalism. The capitalism is born, I would say, maybe in Italy in the 15th century, but his roots are in Italy, but it starts to develop really in the 16th century with Germany and Holland. And so that was then the situation became even more interesting, because at the time the capitalism should develop, those my Incas come to Europe with a kind of socialist system, you know, not only the social security, or I shouldn't call it that way, but to make it simple, sure. Let's say social security, but also with a complete different idea of economy, because they had a very, very centralized and planified economy, you know, which sounds like what they did in the socialist countries, you know, which didn't work very well, actually. But you could imagine that if at the time the capitalism starts growing, it was just cut really like born dead in a way, because Incas overwhelm everybody and bring their own system, then our present world would be completely different, you know. And that's because, yes, from one globalization to another, then if that first globalization would have been so different, then our globalization would have been so. I mean, I can't imagine, actually.
It's such an interesting way to look at it, because I think one of the ways that sort of capitalism, particularly in the last 30 or 40 years, has become so entrenched in our systems is we'll often speak of it as a historical inevitability. It's like it's something which is natural to humans. But in fact, it's perhaps something which is natural to a certain European mindset because of the way, again, the contingencies of history. But it's fascinating to think that if, there had been this sustained contact with another culture, which, as you say, organized things so fundamentally differently that there was no inevitability that this system would win out.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I know some French historians, they work on the history of possible, what is possible, so about alternate history, and they are very their idea is like a large part of historiography, of how we teach history, is to make it to naturalize it, you know, to make it natural, you know. And if you study seriously history, nothing was natural. So and the every time I think that the balance goes on one way or another because of the winners, you know. I mean, the winner takes it all. So this. This is an important question. Who is the winner? because he will shape the world and he will write the history of the world.
I think that's one of the things that works so well about your novel, actually, is that when I was reading it, there were moments when I almost forgot I was reading a counterfactual history, because the sort of the tone of it is... I mean, there are some moments where it's like the journals of Columbus, but other times it's written very much like a sort of a traditional history book, we might say, and a sort of traditional narrative history book. And I think that's a sort of a really sort of unsettling trick you play on the reader, in a way, is that you sort of, you read it, I don't know, 20, 30 page stretch, and then you're like, hang on, but no, this is all, this is all invention. But then it does send us back to a question, the way that we then look at the history, which, as you say, has been naturalized for us. And it sort of, and it undermines that and maybe makes us look a little bit wider for an understanding of what perhaps really happened.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you're right. I mean, all the book is about a trick, you know. I mean, the whole book is a trick. And I wanted it to be first plausible and also immersive.
Yeah.
To create what you say, I mean, which is the best compliment I can hear about the book, like when you forget. But also, I mean, you know, like I always wanted, actually, with my previous novels also, to play with the suspension of disbelief, you know. So I want you to be immersed, but from time to time, I want you to wake up and to remember, to be a conscious reader, you know, okay, well, what I read is not true. What I read is a game, you know. I don't want to convert you to any other story. You know, I mean, I don't I have that question. I had that question several times. You know, what's the difference between your story, your narrative, and fake news, for instance? And the main difference is I expose my trick. You know, mm-hmm. like so I play with it. You know, and sometimes I want you to forget, but sometimes I want you to remember. You know, want to remind you, and that's why there are many. Games like un clin d'œil, I don't know how you say.
Yeah, it's difficult to translate. It's kind of little winks, I guess.
Or private joke for contemporary reader, you know, like
Easter eggs, we could say.
Easter eggs, things like that, you know, like to remind you that this is all a game.
Mm-hmm. it's such an interesting question. Like, what's the difference between this book and fake news? It's sort of a question you could ask about any novel, I think, in a way.
I would say this is the main difference between a novel, between a fiction novel, and, for instance, holy book, you know, mm-hmm. the Bible, or one claims it is the truth, mm-hmm. and the other one doesn't. Yeah. So this is the main difference. It's as simple as that, I think. You know.
Which brings us nicely onto another subject that we wanted to talk about, which was religion. I mean, you mentioned the religious wars. Of course, the Incas come to Europe and they bring their religious beliefs with them. And it's a very sort of heliocentric, sun-worshipping religion. It's interesting because in certain ways, like I've heard that when the Christians first had contact with the Inca religion, there were certain sort of overlaps and certain parallels between the religions that, to an extent, people wondered if the Inca religion, in a very Eurocentric way, could be a corruption of, you know, a lost tribe of wandering Christians. But again, I think in a similar way with the sort of the socialistic politics, one of the things that is really sort of enlightening about the novel is seeing the Judeo-Christian heritage from completely exterior eyes, in a way. So, you know, the way you refer to Jesus as the nailed God, for example, suddenly it's a kind of terminology which we are very used to using about South American religions or religions which are unfamiliar to us, and suddenly seeing religions which our society sort of raised us with couched in those kind of terms and those kind of vocabulary, again, it's that kind of trick of making you look at things differently.
Yes, I think, well, this is always a very stimulating way to change the perspective, mm-hmm. you know, of what you see every day as obvious or what you are so familiar to make you look with a foreign eye, you know, mm-hmm. and this is what did, of course, my models were Montaigne. He did it, you know, with his essays, and Montesquieu with his Lettres Persanes. And I think this is always good, almost healthy for your mind, you mm-hmm. know, like to watch what you're surrounded with a different perspective, you know, mm-hmm. and so it's I think it's stimulating. I think it's stimulating for thoughts, you know, mm-hmm. but also, I mean, for the novelist point of view, it's always funny,
yeah,
you know, because, and especially with religions, because my belief is every religion looked from outside is always funny, uh-huh. you know, like, I mean, very strange and very, you know, all those rituals and I thought it had a comical potential.
Yeah. One of the things that, if we're talking about a sort of specific difference, sort of geographical difference or perhaps geological difference, that we never really had to encounter with in the history that we lived, is the imbalance between gold supplies between Europe and South America. And obviously in sort of European culture, the rarity of gold meant that it was something which was fetishized and which took on value. And in the Inca societies, it was not so. It was a fetishized. There was such an abundance of it that it was something which sort of wasn't held up in quite the same way as in European societies. And you have a lot of fun with that in a novel because, of course, that gives you a very kind of tangible way that this small group of Incas of 200 people can essentially sort of take root in Europe, is that they have access to an almost unlimited supply of gold.
Yeah, that was what I told you about, you know, the advantage. I mean, the advantage you can just use just by luck, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that would be a huge advantage, of course, that they had gold and silver, mm-hmm. you know, and that would help, I believe, to make that scenario mm-hmm. credible, you know, because in Europe, if you have because you could see it with the German banker Fugger, mm-hmm. I mean, the gold is the nerve of the war. Comme on dit en français, how we say in French, the nerve. I mean, this is the lethal weapon, you know. Of and course. So, if Incas, they had that weapon, that massive weapon. I mean, so of course, I mean, they are just 200. They had all a continent to conquer. But once you get that such a huge advantage, mm-hmm. then your chances are increasing to succeed, of course. Yeah, yeah. You know? So yeah, well, I mean, I was always, you know, it's like I was always searching things like that, you mm-hmm. know. Okay, so what is important? Gold is important. Do they have gold? Yes, a lot. Okay, so that's interesting. Yeah, so yeah. I was digging, of course, this lead. As also you spoke about religion, like this religion of the sun, you know, they bring the religion of the sun, which is, well, another religion, not better, not worse than other religions. But they come in America, in Europe, right at the time when Copernicus just explained to the whole Europe that the sun is in the center of universe and not the earth.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, this is the same kind. Again, I was thinking about, you know, Cortés Pizarro, and I thought, I can make the parallel, you know, when Cortés came to Mexico, the Aztecs, they believed he was a god because they were waiting from a god from the sea with a feather in his, the serpent à plume, you know.
The plume serpent, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so he had feathers on his helmet, yeah. And he looked very strange. So they believed he was the god, you know. But so, and so it was a psychological advantage he had, you know. But so I thought, well, that religion of the sun, at the time Copernicus explained that the sun is in the center of universe, could be the same kind of, you know, advantage, like cultural and psychological advantage.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So yeah, I was, as I told you, I was just tracking, I mean, searching for things like gold, mm-hmm. religion, sun religion. And so, and I was always happy when I thought, okay, this could fit, you know. Yeah, it was always about some, yes, like that it could match. So let's go this way, and let's see what happens.
Earlier on, when we were talking about the kind of the great man theory of history, you said, you know, oh, I needed characters. And obviously there are characters that we meet, like there's a really wonderful exchange between Thomas More and Erasmus about halfway through the book. Now, of course, on the European side, you had access to, you know, writings, to journals, to a certain kind of inherited knowledge where you were able to get to know these characters. But I'm curious, because the characters of the Incas are so vivid in the book, I'm curious about how you got yourself sort of into the mind of your Inca characters.
Well, thank you. If you liked my Incas characters, but I have to say it was complicated because, mm-hmm. Of course, I mean, as you said, the archives are not the same. I had to build them in a way with very few materials, sure. You know, but still, it was not non-existent, non-existent material, you know. And so I had with, like, for instance, there was a man, Garcilaso de la Vega, Inca Garcilaso de la Vega. He was half Spaniard, half Inca. Mm-hmm. You know, his mother was an Inca's princess. And he grew in Spain, but he wrote a very important amount about Inca's culture, mm-hmm. you know. So I had, which he knew, you know, because it was his family, he knew his mother. And so it was very, very precious. But also the conquistador themselves, you know, they met Atahualpa, for instance. And they didn't say much, but still they said about him, like he was funny, he was very imperial, you know, I mean, very altier, like
pompous.
I mean, he had some kind of majesty, uh-huh. you know, but also he was funny, uh-huh. he enjoyed to learn how to play chess, he made jokes. And so that was very precious and very, very calm, very calm. You know, when the first time they came with their horses, all the Incas, they were in panic, you know, panicking, but not him, not him. And the story said that all who showed panic, he executed them, you know. So he was also cruel, you know, and things like that. And for instance, like I remember few information, few lines I read by some conquistador. He had an amazing coat made with bat skins, mm-hmm. bat skin, and they were really and they asked him how did you make it, you know, and he said those were those dogs from I don't remember which part of his empire who made it for my father, and because it was a tribe who betrayed him, and they killed them all, you know, and that, you know, that that despise, you know, like those dogs who made it for my father, you know. I thought, okay, so this I had this reaction, this anecdote in mind about the coat and what he said about those who made the coat, and with that few material, I had them to make him. To make him go his way, you know, but so I was really, I had some foundations in my mind, you know, because that anecdote, I think it's very, very little, but very significant, you know, I mean, it tells a lot about his country, about himself, about his situation. So that was a challenge, you know. Mm-hmm. That was a challenge, you know. I mean, either I had too much information about European characters, or too little. Everything was the problem, actually. Problems to solve. But this is what I enjoyed. I mean, this is what my challenge. What was my challenge from the beginning? You know.
In a way, you said like the Incas, they didn't really leave. Sort of archives in a way, and of course the sort of the writing and particularly messaging system wasn't the same. And one thing that, again, I guess this was probably a challenge, and one thing you have to kind of engage with in the book is like how they transmit messages, and the system of it's the quipo,
the quipus,
which is essentially quipus. Sort of, if I'm right, I think it's like strings with knots.
Exactly. Yeah.
And there are a few moments where you give us the messages essentially sort of translated from quipos that Atahualpa sent back to his brother, and also you show us the Inca's fascination with writing and the sort of the power of words on the page and the power of sort of this system developed in Europe.
Yeah, well, because I mean, obviously the writing system they didn't have, they had that different system, which is still not very clear about coding code messages, you know, like the quipus, but they didn't have such thing that, like the books with the alphabet, and But this, I didn't make up the some of them. I'm not sure they are Incas or maybe Aztecs, but they really called it the les feuilles qui parlent, the leaves, the talking leaves, talking leaves, and which I thought it was nice, and it showed the. I mean, yeah, it showed how strange it had to be for them. And, I mean, it's obvious, like, some people, they discussed about my book about, yes, but eventually, who is the best, Incas and Europe, and I really didn't think that way, and I didn't want to make Incas better than what they are, or better or worse, but there were some facts, and one fact is they didn't have such a sophisticated way of writing. They had their quipus, they missed the iron, they missed horses, and they also missed writing.
Yeah. That's one of the things, I don't mean to sort of denigrate the people who asked that question, but I think, in a sense, if the book was about proving or demonstrating that either the Incas were better than the Europeans or the Europeans better than the Incas, it would have been a fundamentally much less interesting book. I think there's a kind of the exercise which you're engaged in, which is a sort of, taking one or two facts, one or two events happening differently, and just seeing how things could feasibly unravel without a kind of a value judgment, allows kind of the reader, I think, to ask questions and to sort of project themselves into the sort of consideration of the two cultures in a way that sort of, if you had an agenda of the Incas are better than Europeans or the Europeans are better than the Incas, wouldn't have.
Yes, I think anyway, I mean, the if you want to prove something, you don't write a novel, because I mean, it's not the right tool for that, I mean, so it wouldn't make any sense. Then, there are some, then I have my own taste, there are some characters I like more than others, but it doesn't have to be all the Incas or all the, and anyway, it's complicated, because for instance, in my previous book, The Seventh Function of Language, you remember I started to change also events, and sometimes I killed some people who was not dead at all at that time, and people believe that if I kill them, it means I don't like them, at all. I mean, I killed them because in the narrative, I had to kill them at that time, and I have to say, for instance, I like Atahualpa, and I like the Incas characters, but I also like Charles V. I mean, I think he's a very interesting character, and I have to say, I didn't like much Martin Luther, he doesn't end very well in the book. But it was not because I didn't like him. Uh-huh. It was just because it was I thought it was a spectacular switch compared to the real history, I was not driven by that kind of thoughts, demonstration. I didn't want to demonstrate. The only thing I wanted to demonstrate is that few change could have that history is not destined. Uh-huh. History is not. That it could have been another way.
Which is a very sort of I think particularly for Europeans, I think should be a very kind of humbling. There are so many sort of we used the term Easter eggs earlier, but so many sort of moments, sort of fun moments in the book where we see how things could have been slightly differently, and we won't have time to sort of talk about all of them, but one of the things that I really enjoyed reading, and I got a sense, maybe I'm wrong, but I get the feeling that you really enjoyed imagining and writing, was that the effect it would have on European art. So we have particularly, there's one where you describe a Titian painting, and you also describe some of Michelangelo's work as well. And there was something, I don't know, really evocative about that, actually, like sort of knowing the work of these artists a little bit and just sort of going along with your description and sort of accepting that they could have produced these paintings you describe. I say it was a really sort of a visual experience as a reader as well. Am I right in thinking that was something that you, one particular thing that you really enjoyed?
Well, I mean, you're right. I mean, it's all about, I mean, for those kind of books, I think it's very important to make it visual, you know. And so the painters, I mean, it was also the it was a time of the Protestantism. It was a time of the growing capitalism, but it was also the time of Renaissance and the those marvels of art, you know, sculptures and painting. And so, and also, I mean, it happens that those painters, they were working for princes, you know, so it was, I thought it was interesting to at the same time to use their painting to rebuild, to invent the situation of my narrative, showed through the eyes of a painter, you know, of a professional worker of seeing, you know. And also it was interesting to show that, of course, I mean, how the politique culturelle, I mean, of this time, the politics, the cultural politics at that time would have been modified, but not that much. You know, they would sell themselves to the acting princes, you know.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And because Titian, he was really the official painter for Charles V, you know.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It was funny to watch what he did, and to imagine what he would have done for Time of Paris. Yes, it was because also, I mean, we had tons of archives from the 16th century, but we don't have photos, of course. So,
sure.
Of course, all those paintings, they were precious material for me, you know. And so I was really for the clothes, the clothes, everything, you know. So it was really, it was very precious. And then, yeah, I mean, precious for in different ways, you know. So I wanted to use them the most I could. Also, it's also funny to imagine Michelangelo working for some Incas, you know, because I mean, it's also like you could imagine the all the artwork of Michelangelo stimulated by such an exotic model, you know. So.
The different iconography.
Yeah, sure.
We're almost out of time, but the last thing I'd like to ask is, you mentioned earlier that the sort of the end point is sort of I don't want to give too much away, but you've mentioned like Cervantes, and we're still in the kind of the 16th century. 16th, 17th century,
17th. No, well, the end should, the end of the book is around the Battle of Lepanto,
okay.
Which means 1571.
Okay.
1572, it's ending at that time.
But there are a couple of moments in the book where you say, for example, which you can still see today in, you know, this church or something like that. And so even though you don't take us as readers up to 21st century fifth quarter Inca Europe, did you sort of imagine how society might be a little bit to yourself in our sort of contemporary time, what the kind of Laurent Binet in this counterfactual universe might have been doing, how he might have been living?
Yeah, sure, but it's more like une rêverie, you know, like, I mean, it's like you can think about it, but if the arborescence,
the
tree of history would have too many branches to imagine, you know, like I could follow like for few years, maybe 40, 50 years, but then But then, I mean, because at every step you could go this way or this way, and then there are millions of possibilities, you know. So I can think about it, but with no single idea, you know. Maybe, well, we should speak Quechua now, not English. I could imagine, you know, Quechua would have been the lingua franca of the world, you know. And
as soon as I press stop on the podcast, we will switch to Quechua for the rest of our conversation.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
Well, as I say, that is all we've got time for. Civilizations, absolutely extraordinary book, a great deal of fun, but also really thought-provoking. Like all of the books on this podcast, it's available from the Shakespeare and Company online store. So the link to which you can find in the show notes to this episode. Otherwise, all that remains for me to say is Laurent Binet, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Shakespeare and Company podcast with me, Adam Biles. Links to the books discussed in this episode are available in the show notes, alongside information about how to become a friend of Shakespeare and Company. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please consider rating it wherever you listen. The intro and outro music is Mr. Ginger by the brilliant Alex Fryman, available on his album Play It Gentle. We'll be back next week. Until then, take care, stay safe, and thanks again for listening.